Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and today I'm joined by Philip Sage.
I'll just start, Philip, with, you sent me a message a couple of days ago on an article I wrote called, it was on Drenick's theorem and some of the cautions about its application. And what sparked that response? You comment every now and then on some of the stuff we were writing and putting out, but this one kind of said, hey, we need to talk about that. So you piqued my interest, so we're on the line now. So what sparked your interest in wanting to talk about this particular theorem in this paper on it?
Well, and Fred, it's good to hear your voice again and to continue our discussions on many topics. And I do follow what you put out on the blog post, and sometimes quietly, other times enjoy the opportunity to forward and share your information onto the LinkedIn process.
Oh, great. I appreciate the support. It's always good to hear if somebody reads it.
And I admittedly had to go pay another $25 to go get another copy of the article, which is entitled The Failure Law of Complex Equipment, mm-hmm. which was published in the Society, the Journal for the Society of Industrial Applied Mathematics back around the 1960 time mark.
That's right.
And I found some of the comments that were made by the professor that you had consulted, Wally, I think is his name.
That's right. Yeah, Wally Tubell.
To be very practical suggestions, but I've also been studying in the background the effects of the failure law of complex equipment for. Fundamentally for several years, but over the last probably 10 years, including looking at the work of Kurtz from the 1930s in his publication of the physical life expectancy of the life expectancy of physical properties, where he laid out a piecewise method to suggest that there was some substance and that even well before the advent of the RCM mantra with the six defined hazard curves mm-hmm. of the different shapes that Kurtz back in 1930 and 1931 was publishing using actual data from the assets of the time and had classified into seven curves and then extended that into a probabilistic argument using a process that was logarithmic and graphical, similar to the Weibull process in many respects, to arrive at the conclusion that no matter with certain qualifying aspects, that no matter the underlying distribution form for the asset in question for one cycle, that given enough time and the absence of maintenance, that process would decay into a steady state that would be rather constant and would rather match some of the expectations. But having said that, I think some of Wally's comments also need to kind of be sprinkled into what I'm saying or suggesting here, okay. that there is a practical side and there is a theoretical side. And in the case of a wear out type of curve, if you were to take that through four or five cycles where you simulate that in Monte Carlo using even the RCM cost or the availability workbench mm-hmm. using the Monte Carlo process, what you'll find is that, in fact, that underlying wear out phenomena reduces after about four or five mean time between failures if, and this is where Wally's comments are so unique and interesting, reduces to a rather constant failure rate over a period of time. So it can actually be rather wildly oscillatory in the early period, or 3 to 4 or 5 mean time between failures. But as the effects of time, you know, replacing an item early or late, depending on the probability distribution, you end up with this quasi state where the combined system of mixed age of components and from a probabilistic perspective, you end up with this general distribution that behaves rather exponentially. So, you know, the comments that Wally made and your comments, I thought, were both founded. But I also saw some interest in understanding the rigorous mathematical proof that Mr. Drenick had put forward from his years of work at Bell Telephone Laboratories, Murray Hill, mm-hmm. in New Jersey, as part of that phenomenal team. And I just saw some interest, and I wanted to, you know, pick your brain and maybe have a little debate, possibly in the spirit of good things, and see what you thought about it. So with that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't know about Kunst, and I'll have to track some of that down and explore that some more. Because it may, like you mentioned, it may be a good, nice precursor to what Weibull did later. But the basic idea of the part I have the hardest part with is, I'm approaching this as a reliability engineer, is that if I'm looking at a complex piece of equipment that may have dozens of different components and subsystems that fail on their own individual patterns, and overall it might be a failure per week, for example, and over time it's give or take a couple of days or a couple of hours, but over a year, if I'm getting about a failure per week, it does look like an exponential distribution at the system level. And the part I don't know how to act on that, though. I have to get way more information to get it to be one failure per 2 weeks, for example. Mm-hmm. I need to know, get a Pareto chart of what are the failure modes and mechanisms, what are the components that are having issues. Well, you know, there's a lot more detail in the individual mechanisms to failure in order to have an actionable plan or to do anything with it. And I find that at the overall system level, I think that has some utility. It's that I find that folks stop at that level. They say, oh, it's an exponential. If we, after a couple of cycles, it's going to settle down and it'll be exponential. And then they do planning based on it's an exponential, independent of bearings wearing out, knowing that they have this phenomena that distinctly don't follow that pattern. That's where I have the problem, is it makes it easy, and I have this theoretical background, and at the system level, it tends to look okay, and then it gets extrapolated into areas where it really shouldn't be applied. That's where I have the biggest issue with this theorems and its promotion around the industries.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Everything you said there, I think you have to be absolutely careful as a reliability engineer and how you apply that. And we can have some discussion about the bathtub curve in a little bit. As it relates to the system level, you could have several underlying wear out failures occurring. And yes, it will appear at the system level after 2 or 3 mean time between failures of the dominant guys that are starting that cycle. Obviously, at the system level, if you've got a failure that isn't going to appear for an extended period of time, that won't be part of the early process. But even if you take a single wear out failure and run it to failure, and that wear out failure has a probability density that is not an infinite spike, then what happens is the early failures, as you look at it from a probabilistic perspective, are going to repeat the cycle. And this is part of the work that Kurtz did. Mm-hmm. And based on the probability, if you were to take a probability density function, and just for giggles, just imagine that it's normally distributed. Often they're not.
Right.
And you divided that up into 10 intervals, and you analyze the amount of probability in the first interval, and then say the second repeat, because that first interval only contains a little bit of probability, it's going to create an identical probability density out at the second mean time between failure, but it's only going to contain the amount of that density is only going to contain the amount of probability that was in the first interval of the first probability density. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you repeat that process 10 more times, and what you find, and mathematically I've calculated that the height, of course, is going to decrease of the second density, and the width or the standard deviation is going to increase. And that's the spreading mechanism, if you will. Mm-hmm. And if you go through that cycle three or four more times, then you start to get into the situation or the potential, and this is where Wally's comments and your comments are spot on. If the mean time between failure relative to standard deviation in the spread of the bell curve starts to overlap, then at any given point in time, the total probability that you have is made up of mixed age generational components.
Right.
Some are on their first failure cycle, some are on their second, some are on their third.
Right, right.
And as a result, the exponentiality look of that individual item when run long enough, which might be longer than we ever run a plant, which is where the other comments that you've made come in, the right. practical side. In theory, yes, if there is no other maintenance action and there's no preventative, there's no condition-based maintenance that's coming in and detecting that problem ahead of time, then if left to run to failure, you will end up with an exponentially distributed looking mixed age population from an individual wear out item.
Right.
And if you combine all those together, you end up, of course, with the exponential. But it's the reality that you have this mixed age population.
Yeah. Well, where's the practical use in that, though, in managing an asset? Why would I want to know that or wait long enough or even just knowing that it asymptotically heads to that, what use is that?
Well, that's a grand question, and Neil's laughing in the background here as well. The implications, I guess, are as we look at the maintenance strategy, that's the practical lever that you pull for most applications of the reliability trade craft, is that we want to devise or craft a maintenance strategy that will combat and reduce the probability of failure and ideally do that at the lowest cost, highest safety margin, highest availability, noting that those three or four different optimization points don't always end up at the same coincident point,
right.
And that we have to sometimes choose in the marketplace to optimize for availability by over maintaining or under maintaining at a slightly lower level to achieve the cost optimal point. But all that said, I think the practical aspects of understanding what can happen, especially if we turn off a section of our maintenance program, then we should expect over a period of time that the performance of any complex asset will begin to look rather exponentially, and that the system level reliability can, as Borofsky pointed out in his text, 1951 publication, that it can fall to a rather ridiculously low level. And I think if I don't have a library with me as I'm traveling, but I seem to recall that he referenced a German author in his discussion and laying that out. So that's another awesome reference for somebody to go look up. And the context of that German and his comments were that no matter what the underlying failure law and pattern of the probability density was, given enough cycles, that you will end up in a exponentially looking thing, but at an individual component level, as a part of the complex machine, the exponentiality comes because of the mixed age phenomena.
Right.
And at a machine level, the exponentiality comes because you've gone long enough and you're adding up the superposition of multiple components that are all acting reasonably exponentially.
Right. Now, are you making an argument to run to failure in most assets?
No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't advocate that for some assets. I think that's based on the cost impact. If that's low, the safety impact, if that is as low as reasonably practical, and from a production and availability of the asset aspect, and coordinated with the storeroom, if you can reasonably obtain one of those parts and change it out in short order without impacting the overall targets of the organization, then those four or five qualifying factors then allow you to decide that a particular component on an asset should be run to failure.
I agree, Philip. I'm going to use an example from my experience. I was working with a bottling plant, putting juice in bottles, essentially. And they had different size bottles and different types of juice they put in it. And what they found was that they would change over a line, they bring up a new size bottle, and they start filling, and the line would experience jams, bottles getting in the wrong position, or, the different stages of going through this filler would get jammed. And the operator would spend, I think it was every 5 to 10 seconds on an initial startup for hours, they had to clear something. So that it was really a start and stop, start and stop, start and stop. For the first day, first shift. The second shift, they would have been making some adjustments to the rails and some other parts of the equipment to dial it in, and then it would run better. And then if they ran for a week, for example, then they would have this really, really low incident rate. And then they started to see PLCs going bad, sensors getting dirty and giving them false readings, motors failing, and other stuff would happen. And then some of the larger failures that they saw from a continuous run, those are the ones that took time to fix. And then they were working hard to figure out how to anticipate those and improve their maintenance program to deal with those. But even the mean time between failure and those jams was seconds. And after hundreds of cycles, I think where it breaks away from the theory and what we've been talking about is that they were adjusting the equipment, trying to actively reduce the amount of problems they were having in their process. So is that scenario, is that enough to say they're far enough away from the theory? And then the other piece of it is, they did this every week. They would change over to a new bottle and they'd run it long enough to get it stable. If I look at 6 months of data at the highest level, then I think they were seeing a very consistent pattern. And if you average it all out, it looked pretty stable. And they were looking at how do we fundamentally lower that startup cost they were dealing with, and also minimizing the downtime from those larger repairs they ran into. But that's a very practical application. And I'm struggling with why the knowledge of Drenick's theorem and this concept would be useful for this plant or for trying to affect any changes there.
Yeah, I, the area that I've been focusing on, and I've been preparing to republish, published many years ago, a book on condition monitoring, but starting to pull in the probabilistic thoughts and views as to why we would condition monitor. And I think that there's an additional argument. And part of the discussion you mentioned, that there was almost, of course, initial startup and very high infant mortality, if you will, allow me to use that term.
Yep.
And then after many, many active adjustments, which you would hope would go we settle into a reasonably low failure rate period. And then we start to see the other actions starting to crop their head up, which were the motors and the longer term issues. I think that, you know, as you look at the global process at a, you know, at a high level, I would think that if we in fact have something that is wearing out and that exhibits a traditionally the traditional view of maintenance, if you will, is that if it has a wear out pattern, that we want to apply some form of a preventative replacement or you know, task on that. And I have some thoughts of, you know, when that might be applicable. But I think that if we have allowed a process to decay into Drenick's area of analysis, that our only true option, rather than trying to mistime a PM because we're now into this random mixed age population of wearing out components, our really only true option is to recognize that that's probably where we are and switch the strategy of, at least for a period of time, into a condition-based strategy where we're going out and trying to detect the problem through some physical change in that part of the asset, and then only with great care. And the part that I'm still struggling with is, you know, when, you know, in the CMMS, do I need to know and do I need to track how long an asset's been in service? And I make that comment in relation to PM programs that specify that I should change the oil in an engine, for example, every 250 hours. But due to other factors and the way that the CMMS has been configured in its master data, I've got a sliding window in that I don't create the work order to change the next oil until 250 hours after the last work order has been completed, which results in a program that slides the maintenance off of the target into the area of higher risk of failure, and you end up changing oil, in this simple example, say every 450 hours, and as a result, you come out of sync with what you were trying to prevent. You know, from a practical sense, I think that there is a very big risk that a well thought out and designed program could be implemented incorrectly in the EAM CMMS. And the result is that after four or five mean time between failures, you see a degradation, you know, a year from now, that we're running the machine less because it's breaking down more because we're out of sequence with our supposition or our knowledge of when that failure might occur, because we're executing the PM program on a sliding scale. So I think there is some application into the justification to avoid or to make sure that if you're going to PM something, that you do it when you say you're going to do it, and then allow the physics of failure and some additional analysis to tell you whether that PM was early or late, to then be the basis for adjusting the number of engine hours in the example I've cited, either higher or lower, to achieve the performance that you're trying to hit. So I think there's something to be said about the theory, and there's certainly, if we were to get into Mill 217 and the bathtub curve discussion, there are times when I think that you have to realize that those types of models have applicability with a contingent set of assumptions that have to be maintained. Otherwise, the model is only as good as it mimics the real world.
That's right.
And if we have fused some of the assumptions, then the modeling to a consistent failure rate in the bottom of the bathtub is not going to mimic the real world, and we're in fact not modeling that action correctly.
That's right. That, when you mentioned the condition monitoring, and knowing that the Drenick wrote this paper, published it in the 1960s, and a lot of the other papers you cited are much earlier, the thought crossed my mind is the concept of condition monitoring. They certainly didn't have the number of sensors and the physics of failure details that we have available today. Yet, I do remember in the first factory I worked in, the senior maintenance engineer could basically just lean against a piece of equipment, or he would walk by and hear something that I don't think anybody else was aware of, and he would do some maintenance or do an alignment or do something, and the equipment just worked. To me, as a young engineer in a factory for really the first time at that level, it was magic how he did that. I wonder, and I'm sure that was available in the first factories, that there were people that became in tune with their equipment. Are we doing ourselves a disservice by instrumenting so many things, or is that... given and doing the statistics and the theory and all that stuff, is that getting us away from that, I want to say craft or skill or that I witnessed in my first plant?
No, I think you've witnessed something that is fundamentally extremely solid. And I also went through the same experience. I was trained in my first factory job was in the steel business by a gentleman who'd been there for about 40 years in his professional career as a electrical millwright. Mm-hmm. and had through the years learned the sounds of each machine when it was performing correctly and when it wasn't. And many wives' tales out there, but some people have held a screwdriver up to their ears. In my case, it was a flashlight that didn't have any batteries, was what we carried around.
Oh, cool.
And you would stick the back end of the flashlight up against your ear with your thumb and push in on that little flap of your ear and then put the flashlight against the bearing. And the practice was that you did that every day. You walked around, you felt the temperature of the bearing in mm-hmm, a safe mm-hmm, spot, mm-hmm. Listened to the bearing. And I am here to tell you that practice did detect things and that we reacted to those, and we went in and we found bad bearings before we took the machine out. So I think that there is a portion of the craftsmanship that's been lost in the belief that a tremendous amount of sensor capability is going to solve all of our problems.
Right.
But I can't... I can't, dismiss having, in 2000 or 2001, the team that I led won the American Iron and Steel Engineers Gold Award for reliability using a vibration and condition monitoring system on mm-hmm. a tandem mill. And that, in fact, was instrumenting stuff at the highest level of available technology back then.
Right.
And we were sampling at 10 milliseconds and collecting 32 gig of data and then replaying weeks of data to analyze quality defects that were being generated by that very complex machine. And we were succeeding in both the identification of the defect. Sometimes 2-3 weeks would go by before we could actually find it in the steel before it, because there was an annealing process in between and a batch process. Mm-hmm. It was meant that if you made a defect, it might be a couple weeks before it got to an inspection unit and you actually got to see it.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. The old guys could do an alignment as good as a new generation laser alignment. We actually had a contest once and the old guys won. the ease at which today you can do laser alignment and confirm, and the data that you get back from the newest generation can't be underestimated, that it now does not take 40 years from a care giving craftsman who has dedicated his life to, you know, to machinery. And a relatively new person can go out there and be very, very successful with the tools that are available.
Yeah, I know there's an advantage to it. And it, what I'm going to tie it back to Drenix, though, is that as we do this sensing, whichever method we use, we're interrupting that pattern to some extent, aren't we?
Yes.
The intent is to maintain uptime and keep our equipment running and not allow it to decay into a state where we get lots of damage, collateral damage to some extent. I think it's good practice in general. And yet I don't really tie it back to Drenick and these other theories. I'm going to start with my first comment or kind of finish here with my first comment is that it's a good theorem. And Yogi Berra that said, you know, in theory it should work, but in practice it doesn't, or something like that. but it's the idea, some of the theories and some of the practices that we have out there are exceedingly useful and some are not. And I think Drenix has, in, as I laid out in the article, a handful of things that it's been misused. It's not that there's anything wrong with the math or the theory in and of itself. It's just that in a practical sense, it's not the way the world works. It's not what we're doing. It doesn't help us in a material way to maintain our equipment.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think that, I think it has been misused because it's been misunderstood. Drenick's theory, I think, and I've worked through a good portion of the math, and I'm inclined to say, given the other supporting documents and studies that have been put out on similar things, including the superposition of renewal processes that have been studied by many back in the early 60s, that there's something to be said when. In fact, on the wall in front of me, I've got an asset that was placed in service about 2014, and it ran a combined total of about 10,000 engine hours, and each failure is plotted as a blue line or a spike, and it is remarkably exponential and constant, and there is, other than some infant mortality, and this particular machine was considered a lemon, during the first year, by the people that maintained it, it demonstrates in practice, at least with the sample of one that I have in front of me today, that it is true. And just looking at what Drenick wrote, and I'll quote, you know, under some reasonably general conditions, and I think that's a wide open statement.
Right.
The distribution of the time between failure tends to the exponential, as the complexity and the time of operation increase.
Right.
And somewhat less generally, so does the time up to the first failure of the equipment. So I think if we just pick this apart a little bit, that can maybe be the final piece of today's discussion, and then we can continue a little bit more. I think under some reasonably general conditions, you have to realize the animal that you're dealing with and why that scenario might be true or why it, in fact, might not be true. The Monte Carlo simulations that I've done, and the nice thing about having a tool available like the Availability Workbench is it allows you to play these what ifs. I put a PM program onto this exponentially decaying process, and what if I had a inspection-based process that honored the PF curve and then did some secondary action task.
Right.
And the result is that those strategies proved to be remarkably effective. However, the residual of the parts that those strategies miss, if they're mistimed, will still decay to a generally exponential, a very low failure rate. But it's generally so low that you don't care about it in the strat. You know, it's kind of like the risk of a star falling out of the sky type of risk.
Right,
it's as low as reasonably practical. So I think there is, and I believe that the proof is probably substantiated given the reviews that occurred between the editors in 1958 through the middle of 1960. There appear to have been several challenges to the theory that have been withstood. So I guess what I suspect that I'll find is that the mathematics behind it is probably sound, or at least reasonably sound, given some reasonably general conditions. The second part, that as the complexity and the time and operation increase, the more exponential it becomes. And I think that given today's machines, as the complexity, theoretically speaking, increases, the model that you would have to build becomes increasingly complex as well, and therefore you have all of these different failure modes operating at different times, mm-hmm. and the summated superimposed result of all of those, if they are assumed to be able to down the machine, would be something that looks rather exponential or randomly occurring,
right.
if run for a long period of time.
And that's where I think it has to be complex enough that no one component dominates the failure mechanism. That it's, if I put in new motors on a piece of equipment and they all fail after 2,000 hours, it's not enough of a mixture of competing stuff. If I'm thinking of a circumstance where there's a labeling piece of equipment and the tech opened it up and says, well, this motor failed and to avoid being back here tomorrow, I'm going to replace them all. And so they all stayed on this lockstep replacement schedule. They went to first failure, then the other five were replaced at the same time. And so that kind of habit or pattern would dominate the failure mechanisms. And what you're talking about is really, if you run to failure and you replace and they all have different ages and there's lots of mixtures of ways they can fail, then I get this system level complexity phenomena. So that would be a situation where you'd have to think about it a little bit differently.
Yeah, if I use the broad advantage that I have in my current position to travel the globe and cite generically the electricity transmission industry, where I've worked with some really cool folks. Mm-hmm. And just for example, if we focused in on the wooden power pole that we plant in the ground around the world, and only the wooden variety, I realize there are many other materials used for supporting an electrical conductor. But the wooden power pole is subject to some kind of a rot process, and it varies with time depending on the type of wood and the type of treatment, whether it's copper sulfate or some other chemical, and the type of soil that has been put into and the environmental conditions.
Right.
But most certainly, every wooden power pole rots out from the inside and exhibits some form of a wear process.
Mm-hmm.
And the standing maintenance strategy is not a preventative replacement after 30 years, quite simply because that's too expensive. And in fact, what most of the utilities around the world that use wood are doing is some form of condition-based assessment to ascertain exactly where the power pole is in its rot curve,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then proactively planning in the future to replace it based on its remaining useful life.
Mm-hmm.
But that power pole population, if you were to take the whole 400,000 poles that, for example, one utility in Australia has in operation, they are much like a complex machine in that they, as a group, are going to appear to fail randomly.
You know, and there's a practical application, Phil. That's kind of what I've been struggling with is now at the utility level, looking at 400K of these poles, is they know they need to replace five a week or whatever the number is. They can mm-hmm. budget and plan for and staff for kind of an ongoing program to deal with a relatively steady arrival of these replacements.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And without, you know, the group or the probability statistics all seem to work, but it's the the individual performance that we're interested in, and only by some form of condition appraisal can we ascertain what the individual current performance is,
right,
and then make a decision to understand where it is and where it sits in the stage curve relative to its brothers that are in the same population.
Right, right. And I imagine that some soils and some areas are in the batch of polls that they received would probably show different patterns, but it's the understanding that physics of failure pattern and monitoring it, they can say, all right, this line is getting closer. We need to increase our inspection routines and you know, stage some more repairs in this area, whereas other areas are much more benign and they're on the same basic curve, but just at a different time scale. And so they can wait longer on those. But it's a step away from waiting for it to fail so that you don't have unexpected downtime and they can manage to keep the availability of power up. So that's all good. Yet I see now that at some level, especially if you're buying lots of these poles and have crews running around the country, that it you don't have to worry about seasonality. You don't have to, at least for this kind of a maintenance operation. I think a good windstorm or fire comes through an area will change your needs and maintenance real quick. We're just heading here in California. We're just heading out of the fire season into the rainy season. So it's
Well, Australia is very prone, and Victoria in particular, where I'm currently living, is very prone to bushfires.
Yes.
And in fact, 9 or 10 years ago, about 270 people were lost in a tragic bushfire that was started by a pole top fire due to, in large in parts, a failed the coronal investigation that was commissioned, cited that in large due to a failed condition inspection of the pole top equipment and the lack of training, which gets us into the whole precision aspect of condition monitoring and how that we know what we know is factual and how we reduce measurement error. But for the purpose of Drenic, I think it's a very good topic to debate, and it understanding that for example, the power poles where you have extremely large populations that are going to present that are all of mixed age, that they should perform that way, and that it has some application, but at the same time, we need more information as reliability engineers. We need to understand exactly what it is that we're working with. And one final note that I'll just throw out there from a reliability engineering perspective, wooden power poles have actually been studied. The earliest recorded data that I have date back into the 1880s in the Prussian telegraph company, and their statistical tracking of the performance of their wooden telegraph poles, which aren't all that different from the wooden power pole today.
Yeah.
So, there's 120 years of reliability engineering. If you want to think about how long have we been doing reliability engineering, and a couple of the best sets of data came from the ladies. So if we go back 110 years, we have I have documented proof that the ladies were most certainly a powerful influence in the field of reliability engineering, and that's really cool to know.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, we'll have to talk some more about that. We'll bring that up another day and dive into that. I wasn't aware of that. Well, thanks so much, Philip, for one, reaching out and saying you wanted to chat about it and agreeing to record this. I'll go ahead and wrap up the recording here, and we can talk a little bit offline. So thanks so much.
Yep. Glad we could connect. You're in the U.S., I'm in Ireland, and soon we'll be back in Australia, and hopefully enjoy the holidays. All the best, and we'll bring it to a close from here. If anybody has any questions and wants to reach out to Fred or myself, please do so. Look forward to hearing from you.
Well said. Thanks, Phil.
To learn more about Drenic's theorem and check out his paper, we have some links to that in the show notes, and a few of the other topics or papers that Philip mentioned during the podcast are in the show notes. You can find them at reliability.fm and follow the links to Speaking of Reliability. And you can find this episode, which I believe is going to be number 279. Now, if you've got an opinion on Drenick's theorem or on other types of mathematical theorems and proofs that are in our history and would like to talk about it, let me know. I'd be glad to share the microphone with you and engage in a discussion that may help others understand where our mathematics and statistics come from concerning reliability. So once again, check us out at reliability.fm under the Speaking of Reliability show, and you can leave us comments and questions there quite easily. Look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.